This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll recap LSU's debacle in Tuscaloosa, the Tigers tumbling to Alabama, 38-17. LSU now 7-3, ranked 18th nationally. Alabama, number one, shooting for its third consecutive BCS title. Also, Bo Clark, the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, he is pushing for more jail time for heroin dealers. He says there's a rise in overdoses and stricter punishment would scare off the sellers. We'll talk about this with Bo Clark and also get an update on homicides in East Baton Rouge Parish. There were 96 of them last year. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We invite your participation, and we also can be reached through email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Today is the 11th day of November, and certainly a significant day for our country as we honor our veterans. And for all those who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, we salute you for your contributions to our country. A not-so-good day for one of the last living World War II veterans in our state, Edwin Washington Edwards, and his wife Trina, have had their reality series canceled without warning, according to reports. So, if the reports are accurate, then Edwin Edwards will no longer be on A&E with his beautiful wife Trina in The Governor's Wife. Last week we had John McGinnis on this show, and he said he wept when he saw the first episode, so I suspect today is an emotional day for the publisher of La Politics. Also an emotional day for Leslie Edwin Miles. He celebrated, if you can call it celebrating, his 60th birthday yesterday. On the heels of a 38-17 defeat at Tuscaloosa to Nicholas Lou Saban and the Alabama Crimson Tide. Alabama, defending national champs, shooting for their third BCS title in a row and fourth in 5 years, the Crimson Tide are. And for Nick Saban, if he wins, it will be his fifth BCS title in the last 9 years. Les Miles has one title in 2007 in his third season, a championship that was won largely with players who were recruited by the aforementioned Nick Saban, who won a national title here in Baton Rouge at LSU in 2003. And when that championship team was honored a few weeks ago at Tiger Stadium, the name of the coach was not recited by the public address announcer, Dan Bornay, at Tiger Stadium. Nick Saban may be a forgotten man when it comes to verbalizing his name, but he's certainly not a forgotten man when it comes to the Southeastern Conference. Right now he is dominating the best league in America, and there has to be concern about this because LSU and other universities have built large stadiums, have huge budgets dependent upon success with the football team, and a competitive balance in the Southeastern Conference. Over $100 million a year is in the LSU athletic budget, and about 75% or more of that comes from football. So without a football team that is among the best in America, LSU stands the chance of having a deficit, which is something that's unheard of when it comes to athletics at Louisiana State University. So there are those Nick Saban followers, journalists like Glenn Gilbo of Gannett, who was on this show a few days ago, who says LSU needs to find a way to get Saban out of the league. He's even suggesting that the coaches in the SEC pony up some money among themselves to give to the University of Texas to lure Saban to Austin, Texas. At 62, he is king of the world. 297-5633. What does this mean for LSU, and do we have things out of proportion? Next year, the stadium, Death Valley, expands to 101,000 patrons, and the morsels on the menu for LSU include Sam Houston State, University of Louisiana Monroe, New Mexico State, which has won one game this year, 1-9. They'll be one of the entrees for LSU next year. And then in the conference, the Tigers play their traditional four games from the SEC at Tiger Stadium, but Kentucky, winless in the SEC this year. Mississippi State, a team that hasn't defeated LSU in more than two decades. Ole Miss and Alabama. So the home schedule is not that great, considering that ticket prices are going up and that fans are being asked to pay top dollar for competition that may not be top-notch. 877-217-5757 or Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Certainly a disappointment at Tuscaloosa, but Alabama was a 12-point favorite. Saban now 5-3 against LSU since he returned to the college game in 2007 at the University of Alabama. And since 2008, in the league, the Southeastern Conference, Alabama is 45-4, 45 wins and four losses against Southeastern Conference competition, 5-2 against LSU in that time, and 40-2 against everybody else. So Saban has the program at Tuscaloosa at a level that is comparable to the level that Bear Bryant had when in his heyday at Alabama. Between 1971 and 1981, Alabama beat LSU 11 straight years. It cost Charlie McClendon his job as LSU's coach, but Alabama was beating almost everybody else with the same kind of ferocity and frequency. Alabama, during those 11 seasons from 71 to 81, was 69 wins and four losses in the Southeastern Conference. So LSU, I think, according to most observers, has facilities that are equal to or superior to anybody in the conference, including Alabama, has a bevy of recruits that are available in a state that loves football and produces football players galore, is the only major school in Louisiana with a top-notch college football program as far as competing for BCS honors. Alabama, which is a state comparable to Louisiana in size, has another school right in the Southeastern Conference competing against the University of Alabama, Auburn, which is also a top-ranked team and won the national championship a few years ago. So how does Alabama do it and LSU not do it? It appears that you got to give credit to the coach. Maybe Alabama has the best coach in the country. And it's doubly galling for LSU because the Fighting Tigers had Nick Saban for 5 years. And when he arrived here in 1948, he had not even seen the campus, took the job after being head coach at Michigan State for 5 years, arrived in Baton Rouge at the end of 1999, took over a program that had eight losing seasons in its previous 11 seasons, and won the Southeastern Conference in his second year, and by the fourth year, Saban had LSU hoisting the Crystal Trophy as the BCS champs, defeating Oklahoma in the BCS championship game. And then in his fifth year, he got restless, went off to the Miami Dolphins, lost 17 of 32 games in 2 years as head coach of the Dolphins, comes back to the University of Alabama, something he said he would not do. Had a mediocre first season at Alabama, going 7-6, but he did inherit a program that had lost 19 of its previous 32 Southeastern Conference games. And then after that, Alabama started dominating and doing so in a big way. The Crimson Tide won the national championship in 2009, 2011, 2012, and now if they win... the rest of their games, they'll be champs again. They've got to beat Auburn. They've got to win the SEC championship game, and certainly they have to defeat a strong foe, maybe Florida State, maybe Ohio State, maybe Baylor. Somebody tough will play Alabama in the BCS title game. But based on history, Saban is emerging as kind of a John Wooden-type coach. That was a question from a listener about the comparisons between Saban and Wooden, the legendary coach at UCLA. Wooden won 10 national titles at Westwood and on the basketball court. And I think there are some valid comparisons as far as success. One thing Wooden did not have, though, when he left, according to his good friend Dale Brown, when John Wooden retired in 1975, he was earning $35,000 a year. $35,000, 38 years ago. Today, Nick Saban makes about $6.3 million, does not include endorsements. And chances are, wherever he's coaching next year, whether it's in Austin or Tuscaloosa or somewhere else, Nick Saban will be around the $10 million range. When Mark Emmert hired him as head coach at LSU in 1999, Saban was earning about $600,000 a year at Michigan State and asked to have his salary doubled to $1.2 million. And at Michigan State, by the way, Saban's record was 34-24. He certainly wasn't a world beater. They never won a Big Ten title. They only had one season that was really good in 5 years. Lost to LSU 45-26 in a bowl game in the Independence Bowl of 1995, and yet Saban parlayed that into a 5-year, $6 million deal as head coach at LSU, and it turned out to be one of the best investments that LSU ever made. It made Saban, made Mark Emmert, and they both are doing other things, or at least doing them in other places. Emmert is head of the NCAA, Saban is head coach of LSU's arch rival, and LSU has the galling aspect of facing Mr. Saban once a year, and they have won 3 times against Saban, but now have lost 5 times, and the most notable was the BCS championship game of January 9th, 2012. Think about it, that was only 22 months ago in the Superdome. LSU comes in 13-0, Southeastern Conference champions, having defeated Alabama at Tuscaloosa, and loses to the Crimson Tide 21-0. Alabama rallied to beat LSU last year at Tiger Stadium, winning 21-17. And then last Saturday, 2 nights ago, LSU faltered in Tuscaloosa, falling to the Crimson Tide 38-17. So LSU now regroups, has a week off, and in 2 weeks, the reigning Heisman Trophy winner, Johnny Manziel, the quarterback from Texas A&M, who defeated Mississippi State 51-41 last Saturday. Johnny Manziel comes to Tigertown, and there's bound to be a packed house. And if LSU wins that game, at least there'll be hope for next year. If the Tigers falter, though, I think Joe Aleva is going to have some head scratching as far as what he does next year, because the fans are going to be in revolt. There's no doubt that the standards of years ago, winning 8 or 9 games and being a successful season, those standards are long gone. They have passed. LSU now expects a victory, and victory in a big way, and competing for BCS championships and competing for Southeastern Conference championships. Nothing short of that is acceptable. And because of that, LSU's fans, if they don't have the beast fed in the way they wish, they may ultimately revolt and cause some concern about budgets, because 101,000 fans, 7 nights a year, when you're playing the likes of Sam Houston State, New Mexico State, UL Monroe, and Kentucky, those are not the kind of marquee games that generally pack the stands. Now, LSU does have a chance to sign what is thought to be the best recruit in America, the running back Leonard Fournette from St. Aug in New Orleans. And you would think that if Les Miles is capable of doing that, then it'll be a whole new ball game, and fans will be revved up about 2014. But this is a critical time for the LSU football program, no doubt about it. And if LSU is to stay at the level it was under Saban in the early years of Miles, something has to be done, and done fast. 297-5633, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we'll also hear in our time today from the coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish, Dr. Bo Clark, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And in a few moments, we'll hear from the coroner, Dr. Bo Clark of East Baton Rouge Parish. Did want to note that the Saints certainly did well. They took care of business last night. Drew Brees, 393 yards, four touchdowns. Saints, 49. Cowboys, 17. And Southern University went to Montgomery, Alabama, Saturday and fared much better than LSU did in Tuscaloosa, defeating Alabama State 31-28. Southern's now 6-4, 6-2 in the SWAC with a non-conference game against Clark Saturday at A.W. Mumford Stadium before ending the regular season against Grambling in the Bayou Classic on November 30th. Bo Clark coming in a few moments, but we'll stay with this for a few more minutes. 297-5633. Charles on North Foster. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Let me say this to the LSU fans, and you know I'm a Southern graduate, but I cheer for LSU. I want them to do well. If we look back at that 2011 game, there was a controversy with Jordan Jefferson. If we look at that Alabama loss last year, if you have the Honey Badger on the field, he doesn't rush the quarterback. He tackles the running back. LSU wins. What we have here at LSU in acres of diamonds of talent, a football player here in Louisiana, I think is a great disconnect between the African-American community and LSU, and Nick Saban is exploiting it along with a lot of other coaches. I mean, look what Vanderbilt did Florida. This doesn't need to be this way. LSU should be encouraging and have connections at all of these schools, both athletically and academically.
Okay,
and
hold on, Charles. Why is there a disconnect?
Well, there's a perception in the African-American community that our student-athletes are taken for granted, that they have literally no choice but to come to LSU, and a lot of these young men and their families and communities feel like, wait a minute, we're not going to be taken for granted. When LSU has an athletic department that looks so much different than the rest of the student body, that's a problem. But it's also an opportunity. I think if LSU takes the lead in saying we value African-Americans in and outside of the athletic department, they could have a tremendous program that would be second to none in many sports, not just right, football. Well, we're talking baseball. We're talking basketball.
The student body at LSU is about 11% African-American, much lower than the state, and some would say that's not a good thing, but that's the way it is. And I would think, I've looked at these things, the athletic department's pretty close to that. There are no African-Americans who are running the show, but you have a black basketball coach in Johnny Jones, an African-American female basketball coach in Nikki Caldwell. The football team, Charles, is well over 80% African-American. It seems some strides have been made. Are you ignoring the progress
place? I'm not ignoring that strides have been made. I'm saying that those strides are absolutely far below where they should be. LSU should be able to walk into any high school, even middle school in Louisiana, and identify talent and help develop talent athletically as well as academically, and we don't see that. Let's take, you mentioned Southern during the break. Southern's coach was in a camp run by Nick Saban last summer. Why wasn't Leslie Miles running camps for all these coaches who wanted to attend here in Baton Rouge? We're talking simple things. We're not talking about difficult things, but let's take South Baton Rouge. You have all these African-American students here in Baton Rouge. What outreach program does LSU have? You know, we're not going to be taken for granted. And I'm no fan of Alabama. Trust me, I'm no fan of Alabama. But Nick Saban can come here and recruit as easy as Les Miles, and I believe that's a big problem.
Well, one thing you and I can agree on, I think, is that if LSU is going to play Sam Houston State, New Mexico State, and UL Monroe at home next year, then they should be playing Southern University instead of one of those teams. Can you imagine the spectacle?
Listen, if I was paying top dollars for those tickets to sit in Tiger Stadium, I would want to see games that mattered. But at the end of the day, LSU can go into these universities and say, we're going to help lift your level of play up because the higher the state performs, the better we'll perform. And I think everyone would agree with that. They should have, we have acres of diamonds of football talent here in Louisiana, and those acres are being formed, and those diamonds are going to other campuses, particularly Alabama. And I don't want to see that young man from St. Aug leave Louisiana, but LSU needs to understand they're more than just football players at St. Aug, at Capital, at, you know, these other high schools that produce these high-caliber athletes. And if they do that, we got a winner. And Les Miles, come into the community. We like you. I don't have to.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Charles. Take care. 297-5633. And now we switch gears just a bit, and we're joined by Bo Clark, the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish. Good morning, Dr. Clark.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, you're fighting what you believe is an increase, and I think the studies, the information bears out what you're saying, that there is a significant increase in heroin use in Baton Rouge. How significant is the increase?
Well, in 2012, we had 5 cases that were related to heroin toxicity, and to date, in 2013, we have 27 confirmed cases with 2 cases that are still pending results. So I'd say that's a pretty drastic increase. We're almost moving on to a sixfold increase.
How many of those people have died?
All 29 cases are death cases, 27 being confirmed.
27 this year?
That's correct.
Okay, so what do you do? You're pushing for stronger jail time for heroin dealers. Is that the panacea for this?
Well, I think you got to go back and analyze it and diagnose why this has taken place in our community. And in 2010, 2 things happened. The first thing we saw was the advent of what's called the Prescription Monitoring Program, and this was an online program put out by the Louisiana Board of Pharmacy that allowed physicians, when they're treating a patient, to look up their prescription history, specifically as it relates to narcotics use. The ultimate goal of the system was to prevent what's called doctor shopping. And in doing so, it was very successful in reducing the number of narcotic prescription drugs we see on the street. And that created a market for folks with substance abuse or addiction disorders to seek other forms of opiates, namely heroin in this case, to use because they couldn't get their hands on the prescription pills. The second thing in 2010 was Louisiana legislature reduced mandatory sentencing for the distribution of Schedule I narcotics, which heroin is, from mandatory life sentencing down to 5 to 30 years. So, again, creating an environment that may be more equitable for a drug dealer to come in our community and sell the drug. So I think that's the diagnosis. And then, of course, what is the treatment plan here? I think it's twofold. Number one, we have to maybe swing the pendulum back towards the center in regards to the penalties for the distribution of heroin and make it less feasible, again, for drug dealers to want to come into our community and even sell the drug. And then second of all, after we do that, then we have to start considering how do we manage our patients that have substance abuse and addiction problems and how do we treat them. And I don't have a clear answer for the second part of it, but I think that the first thing that needs to happen is, of course, the penalties.
297-5633 for Coroner Bo Clark, who ran for this office, what, last year?
We did it in 2011, took office in 2012.
Okay. It's hard to believe how time passes. So
yeah.
October 22nd of 11 was the election, and Clark is a Republican, medical director for the Louisiana State Police Special Weapons and Tactical Team, and was assistant medical director for the Ascension Parish Sheriff's Office SWAT Team. So you're familiar with law enforcement. Mike Irwin is calling for life sentences for heroin dealers. He says, I think we can make a strong argument that if you're a nonviolent offender, that if you're selling heroin, you're not a nonviolent offender. That is a sentiment that is shared by others. I would think you're probably in accord with Judge Irwin.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you've heard the argument of violent versus nonviolent, but I'm looking at 27, potentially 29 people that have died as a result of someone selling them a drug. So I don't know. I mean, I consider that violent at the end of the day.
Why is it such a lethal drug?
Well, Unlike prescription pills, which are monitored by the FDA, you know you're getting a known quantity of in that prescription. So if you're receiving a hydrocodone pill, you know there's 10 milligrams of hydrocodone because the FDA is involved. With heroin, you're buying a baggie full of powder-like substance, so you don't know even if it's heroin. It could be 0% heroin. It could be 90% heroin. So when you inject whatever volume it is that you're used to injecting, and it's a 90% heroin, then you get the extreme effects of the drug, which are central nervous system depression and respiratory depression, and basically you stop breathing, and that's what kills you.
Well, it's been reported that in 1994, 19 years ago, the former mayor of Baton Rouge, Pat Screen, succumbed to a heroin episode in New Orleans. It is a lethal substance, especially used with other drugs. Are these people that you have found with heroin, if they had other drugs in their system?
Usually they do. However, there have been a few cases that were simply isolated to just heroin.
And you say there are 27 this year, correct?
27 confirmed deaths as a result of heroin, with two deaths that are pending toxicology.
And how many last year?
Five in all of 2012.
So are there heroin dealers moving in here saying this is a good place to set up shop? Is that what's happening?
Well, I would think so. If the law for their punishment, if caught, is minimal, then certainly they're probably willing to take the risk, I would imagine.
I certainly don't know what it costs to purchase heroin on the street or anywhere else, but I would imagine this isn't a drug that's cheap, is it?
It's now becoming cheaper than prescription pills because there's fewer and fewer prescription pills out there. So when you talk about opiates in the whole, it's becoming the cheaper opiate to get.
Okay. So when you say cheaper, what does that mean?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd heard the cost of a prescription pill used to be between $10 and $20, is now upwards of $60, and the heroin is now the one that's in the $10 to $20 range.
All right. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757, or Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Coroner Bo Clark with us. He has drafted a tentative proposal to raise the mandatory minimum sentence for dealing heroin to 30 years. And he is concerned because he says the deaths in Baton Rouge thus far this year related to heroin are at least 27, maybe 29, up from 5 a year ago. Antoine asks about the demographic makeup of these victims. Are they old, young? Are they black, white, male, female? What's the general composition?
It's everything across the board, male, female, different levels of the socioeconomic status, certainly different races and different ages. So there's no one person that you can say, oh, this is a drug death related to. And, you know, the fill in the blank could be anybody.
So you're saying it's some folks of means as well. It's not just people out on the street buying a bag of heroin.
Absolutely.
So this drug, it's been around for a long time. It's not like it's a new thing. It must be capturing the fancy of some people.
Well, it's been present for a long time. It's been around for a long time. It just hasn't been present, or at least in the levels that we're seeing it now, leading to so much death.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that this drug has been glamorized in places. When Lou Reed died, you may or may not be familiar with the rocker who died a few days ago, Coroner Clark, but Terry Gross of Fresh Air paid tribute to him and chose one of his songs, which essentially is a love song to heroin, and played it on her show. And J.C. Kane has a sampling of Lou Reed extolling the virtues of heroin. Right. This is serious stuff, though. It's nothing to be played around with, based on what you're telling us.
That's correct.
So do you think that tightening sentencing on this, making people pay for dealing it, is that the primary way to curb this, or is there a way to go to the user and try to convince these people that it's not a good thing?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. You have to do both, really. You have to make it not an option because it's so deadly. And then you have to go out there and use what we know in the medical world to treat folks that have substance abuse and addictive disorders. And there's been drugs that have been manufactured and made that are regulated, such as methadone, and there's a new drug called Suboxone, which addictive disorder doctors use to try to get folks off of opiates and not be opiate dependent. So yes, there's definitely a treatment side to all this, but you've got to differentiate. The dealers are not the users, and you've got two groups of people you're dealing with. You've got the folks that are dealing the drugs, and those are the ones we're talking about that need to have stricter penalties. And then you've got the patient or the addict, who, of course, needs help for their addiction.
Tune in 756-33-HB in Denham Springs. You're on with Dr. Bo Clark, the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish.
Who was you calling, Mr. Jim?
I called HB.
Oh, okay. I couldn't understand you. Thank you. Doctor, in my 30-plus years on the streets in Baton Rouge, we once read an article in Narcotics that said that if the drug trade, prescription or otherwise, underground drugs, was a business and listed on the New York Stock Exchange as a business, it would make the profits of ExxonMobil look like a snowball stand in New York City in the middle of winter. Your opinion, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think it is a business. It's just certainly not legitimized through tax purposes or, in the eyes of the government. But that's exactly, if you break it down in its fundamental basis, what happened. You created, with the changing of the law, created a better business environment for the drug dealer to come into the community and sell their product.
When somebody dies a terrible death from heroin use, it's not a pretty end, is it?
It's devastating. I mean, you can imagine their family. I mean, these people have families, and they might have children, or they might have parents, and certainly the wake of destruction that's left behind from their addiction. And a lot of these folks, it wasn't their first time they actually tried heroin, and they've been addicted to something, whether it was pills or heroin, for a time, and it's finally caught up to them. So I think that's why the second part of helping our community is to figure out how we're going to help these folks that have problems.
Do they go to sleep and not wake up? Do they have a violent end? What usually happens?
It's usually go to sleep and not wake up, because what happens is the respiratory centers of the body are depressed, and you start to breathe less and slower, and then your body's robbed of oxygen, both your heart and your brain, and then life ceases after that.
297-5633, Pastor Randy and Zachary, please be brief, Randy.
Dr. Clark, I heard you were saying about particularly the people that could use this drug, could be anybody, but can you identify for us who are the sellers that are selling this drug, and then what are your concerns about the crystal meth use in our...
All right.
Two-part question. First of all, the people that are selling, I don't come in contact because my jurisdiction only extends to the folks that have died. So that would probably be more appropriate for law enforcement, because they're the ones out on the street trying to catch the dealers. The second part of the question was related to crystal methamphetamine. Believe it or not, we don't see a whole lot of deaths that are directly associated with crystal meth.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with Dr. Bo Clark. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 for Coroner Bo Clark, East Baton Rouge Parish. He says there have been at least 27 deaths associated with heroin use in this parish in this year, up from 5 a year ago. Tim on Airline. Tim, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I would assume that the alcohol-related deaths in the state are much higher, so I'm wondering if we should start charging like bars and places that distribute alcohol for the people's deaths.
Do you have a response to that, Coroner?
I mean, we certainly see deaths that are directly related to alcohol, but they're not necessarily to the direct cause that we're seeing with heroin.
297-5633, 96 homicides last year in East Baton Rouge Parish. The reports this year indicate that number will go down. Do you have any handle on how substantially it will decrease?
Yeah, we've seen a pretty significant increase this year in homicides so far.
Decrease
this year in homicides so far. I think we're about 20 below where we were this time last year. So that's incredibly significant, and certainly not happy that there were any homicides, but happy there are less.
Mm-hmm. So what do you attribute it to?
I think certainly the district attorney's office and the sheriff's office and the police department have been out on the street with their new BRAVE program, and through some proactive police work, I think that's certainly made an impact in the community.
Okay. I see last year the East Baton Rouge Parish Coroner, meaning Dr. Clark, issued 604 orders of protective custody. That was up from 131 from the year before. How's that looking this year?
Believe it or not, it looks like we're going to be a little bit higher this year. The two things that the coroner does when it relates to mental health is, first, we take citizens, witnesses, sworn affidavits, and that's what's called an order of protective custody. When someone might have a mental health problem, we can take them into custody and bring them to a treatment facility for evaluation. And those are either on track for being the same or, if not, a little bit more. And then on the back end of that, there's what's called a coroner's emergency certificate, which is an involuntary committal of a patient for a maximum of 15 days in a psychiatric facility for treatment. And we're seeing an increased number of those as well. So it certainly seems that we're getting more mental health cases in our community. I don't know if these are the result of new mental health cases or if there's some recidivism that is occurring with patients entering the system and then coming back out and reentering the system.
Well, last year there were 2,509 total deaths, natural deaths, reported in East Baton Rouge Parish. How many of those people do you personally see?
Most of the natural deaths in our community are usually either under the care of a physician at a hospital or the result of hospice care, meaning they have a terminal illness. The other ones are the ones that we actually attend to, meaning someone dies of natural causes, but they die in their home, and we go out and we attend to those. So we do upwards of about 70 scene responses per month. And that, of course, includes all manners of death, both accidents and suicides, homicides, and naturals. But still the vast majority of the manner of death that occurs in our community is natural death.
70 a month. So you probably see 1,000 dead bodies or close to it every year.
Probably so, yeah.
Does that change your outlook on things?
No, I think you have to have the way I believe is you have to have faith and family and rely on those two infrastructures, and I do personally in my life, so that I can manage some of the stress that's related to this job.
Well, you have been on the job a couple of years. You're a young man. Our friend Hippolyte Landry, who calls this show on occasion, some people hold on to this job for a long time. You got to have a certain type of temperament, I would think.
Yeah, you do.
Well, we wish you well.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Jim. Take
Coroner
care.
Bill okay. Clark. Thank you. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. As we were parting company on this show Friday, the governor was en route to New Orleans to greet the President of the United States, who arrived in our state to deliver a speech regarding the economy. They shook hands, and it's to the governor's credit that he met the president at the airport. That's a nice thing from somebody from the opposing party. But but after shaking his hand and having a brief conversation with the president, the governor said, "We will not allow President Obama to bully Louisiana into accepting an expansion on Obamacare." So the gloves are off. Got two lean guys, one a Democrat, one a Republican, and Bobby Jindal's talking like a tough guy again, as he did when he said it was time to put on your big boy pants, and sooner or later somebody might take him up on this. The latest word about a former governor is that Edwin Washington Edwards will no longer have a reality show, which primarily featured his beautiful new bride, Trina, his third wife. The governor's wife apparently has been canceled by A&E. The show aired 2 weeks ago and got less than sterling reviews, and then re-aired last week, and then yesterday, four of the remaining episodes, the four that were in the can, ran between the hours of 10 and noon, and the show's regular scheduled time was filled by Duck Dynasty. A few days ago on this program, we had John McGinnis of La Politics in-house, and here's how he commented regarding his viewing of the governor's wife. Do we have John? JC? We're trying to bring up Mr. McGinnis, who wrote Cross to Bear and The Last Hayride, two huge books about Governor Edwin Washington Edwards, and watched the governor's wife and said he was moved. But apparently McGinnis is silent as we speak, so we'll bring in for a... Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, if we can get him.
People tuning in expecting to see Edwin Edwards in his prime and popping off one-liners and the show being about him. But he's sorely disappointed. He spends a lot of it kind of, you know, puttering around this house, turning the lights off, while Trina is front and center. This show's about Trina. And especially when she got on and was talking about her relationship and hopes of having a baby, she's tearing up and choking. I was crying too, but for a different reason.
It was
a tough one, man. Yeah. But so we'll see. And people tuning in, they expect.
All right, that was John McGinnis giving his review, not so charitably, of the governor's wife. Michelle Southern, who's the assistant news director at the Louisiana Radio Network and a friend of Trina and Edwin, and I think was scheduled to be on one of the coming episodes. I'm sure the wife of the governor, Trina, former governor, is somewhat perplexed by this. This was really something she took a lot of satisfaction with.
She really did, and she was really hoping for a second season. Even said that she wanted the subject of the second season to be the Edwards go on the campaign trail.
297-5633 if you'd like to comment on this or anything else. But Steve Winham, the former budget director for Buddy Romer, says, "Who could have guessed this high quality slice of life documentary series would fail?" So, I don't know. I suspect Steve's being a little facetious here, but there were some people who liked the show, and as these things go, just not enough people to keep it going. And it's a novel concept. You don't find too many 85-year-old or 86-year-old four-term former governors who met third wife in prison. You don't find too many couples quite like this, especially not in Ascension Parish, Michelle.
Right, and I think that a lot of people, like you were saying, wanted to see more of Governor Edwards. And, also there was just cussing, and I don't think that it really made them look quite like they were hoping, maybe even Trina.
Well, Leo Honeycutt, his biographer, who declined to be with us after hearing this this news that Steve Winham described as tragic, he said that this could unfortunately affect the Edwards' legacy, at least if it lasted long enough, because he needed to make sure that the governor was remembered for what he did. He was the leader of Louisiana for 16 years as governor, but for America, a lot of people were introduced the first time to Edwin Edwards on the governor's wife.
Right. And I think that another thing that was pretty disappointing to a lot of people is the way that they described how she got pregnant and the exact details that they went into to describe that. But, you know, and I have to say that even for me, I thought that was a little much.
Really? Well, they actually were there when the baby was born, weren't they?
Yeah. Trina said that they filmed it themselves, and I didn't see it. I didn't see the finale, which I was supposed to be on, actually, yesterday, because I didn't know that it aired yesterday morning. and I did DVR it, and so I guess I'll watch it later today and see.
Okay. 297-5633, Rose in Sherwood Forest. Rose, good morning. You're on the air with Michelle Southern and yours truly. Hi, Rose.
Good morning. Yes, I watched the very first episode and could barely sit through it. And after that, I said, oh, my God, this is so exploitive. I mean, the way they showed his children and poor Vicky, I really felt for his oldest daughter. So that's my only comment. And it was just hilarious. I mean, it just made it look like it making our state a laughing stock.
Imagine that. Some would say it was so bad it was good. Vicky seemed to be getting into it.
Right. I was wanting to see, you know, what happens next.
Well, Cassidy, and I think this is someone other than the congressman, says, why weren't the other sons featured on the program, David and Stephen? It's as though he didn't have two sons. They were long and forgotten.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess they didn't agree to be on the show. When I went to the baby shower, everybody who walked in had to hold up a sign with their name on it, and that they either agreed or didn't agree to be on camera. And a lot of people didn't agree to be on camera.
Well, last week when we had John Kennedy on the show, the state treasurer, he said that this museum for papers for Governor Foster, that it's something that could or should be replicated by other governors. We could have a similar thing in Bossier City and one in Crowley and one in Lafayette. And Bob Mann said we could have one in Jonesboro for Jimmy Davis. So does that mean every former governor of Louisiana now gets a reality show?
I don't know. I don't know if another former governor is married to a 34-year-old girl and they have a baby. I mean, it's a good premise for a reality show.
It's something that is like a car wreck. You can't stop.
Right.
But
it was really scripted, and I don't know. I'm half surprised, I guess, to see
it. I guess the question is, you're a friend of Trina. Do you think this will affect their relationship?
I don't know. I don't think that it's going to affect their relationship, but I don't think she's happy about it.
About the cancellation?
Yeah. I mean, I texted her this morning and asked her, and she didn't respond, which is
really
unlike her. And she's not posting on Facebook, which she always does. I'm sure she'll address it eventually, though.
Well, but life goes on, and she has plenty of life left with a newborn, Eli, mm-hmm. and they're already talking about him running for governor at some point.
He's adorable, too. He's so cute.
Well, as I've said, I think I've said it here, and I don't think I would be alone in saying that Eli's chances of being governor of Louisiana probably exceed President or Governor Jindal's chances of becoming president. The odds are just so overwhelming against Bobby Jindal that even though he's planning on trying, it's tough to win. You got to have everything fall in place. Where on the other hand, we have elected an Edwards governor on four occasions, and this guy will be the son of the Cajun prince. So he would seem to be somebody who would immediately have a fascination, or people would be fascinated by him. So we could have Ewe in 43.
Maybe so.
He'll be, what, 30 years old then?
Right. He has a onesie that says that already, actually.
Ewe in 43?
Yes.
And let's see. Edwin was born in 1927, so he'll be 116 then.
Right.
And, you know, he's beaten the odds before. He might make it.
Yeah.
But if he had gone 51 years in the opposite direction for a bride, his wife would have been born in 1876. But his current bride, who was on this show, very gracious. And by the way, I understand she got her degree in accounting recently.
I didn't know that.
That's what I hear. So
well,
she could do a lot of things. Smart lady. She is 51 years and a few days younger than Edwin Washington Edwards. Now has three boys and has a family to raise. And obviously at 86, I would imagine Edwin Edwards needs some attention, too.
Exactly. So, they're very happy.
So perhaps there's a blessing in the cancellation of this reality show that they'll get to spend more quality time with one another.
And she also said it was exhausting, that the entire venture was really, you know, hard on them. So, you know, I think she'll have mixed feelings about the show being canceled.
Well, someone has just written, JC, who is it? Terry wants to know if you think they would make a good radio duo.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, hey, you never know.
As long as, you know, I would like to see more from the former governor if he does more.
Yeah,
I think
that's
what people want to see.
He is so quick. It's hard not to be captivated by him because He is a man who has just an amazing ability to snap back when he is questioned, and that show really didn't present that, as John McGinnis said. It was more about her, and John thought it would have been a better show if it were more about the governor. But the governor didn't seem to mind taking a back seat, did he?
No, not at all. No. Nor does he in life now.
It's amazing. A man who was the most powerful person in Louisiana, as he said when I'm asked, as I did, I asked him a few weeks ago, who the most powerful politician was, influential politician in the 20th century. He says, I see him every morning when I look in the mirror. Well, but he did not mind taking a back seat to Trina Scott Edwards, who is beautiful, but will no longer be presented in her glory on A&E. The governor's wife canceled early Sunday without warning. The nerve of those people at A&E, right?
I can't believe it.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
And thanks to J.C. Kane. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.